We thought we had gotten used to uncertainty in the global economy, and then came coronavirus. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, February 7th, and thanks for joining us. Now, we have, of course, been following the coronavirus story. Its human toll is growing. We're also going to have a personal story about one U.S. business struggling to deal with its impacts a little later in the program. But to start us off, the Federal Reserve Board said today that the virus now poses a, quote, new risk to U.S. markets and global growth. Here to talk about all of that, plus the other economic news of the week, are our two weekly wrappers. Anna Swanson is with the New York Times. Sandeep Reddy is at Politico. And they both join us from our D.C. bureau today. Hey, you two.
Hey, Molly.
Hey there.
All right. Let's start with this coronavirus news. And I'm going to channel Kai Rizdahl, because I know that he has been asking each week during the weekly wrap, is this virus potentially the black swan event that triggers the next recession? So far, it's mostly been no. Sandeep, I'll start with you. Is that changing?
It could be changing. We talk about black swans as if we obviously were not expecting this, but now we also have a black hole of information. We don't know what is going on in China right now. That is the core of the fear that's going through economists and traders and everyone else around the world who has to deal with this. Is information flow out of China, being a closed communist society, is very difficult, and there's a lack of trust with the global community. And when you have a lack of trust, you have fear. So that's what we're going through right now, and we don't know whether this is going to be a few weeks or a few months or a few years. And when you have that kind of uncertainty, you have a big problem on your hands when you're trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next few weeks or months or years.
Right. Now, of course, we also had conversations with China this week about implementing part of the phase one deal to cut tariffs. Anna, how do these ongoing trade conversations affect this growth picture? And then where does the virus play in with all of that?
So it does seem likely that the spread of the virus is going to delay the implementation of the U.S.-China trade deal, especially the big purchasing component that the country agreed to, $200 billion of additional purchases over the next couple years. It definitely looks like that is going to be pushed down the line, and some of those other promises are going to be called into question. In terms of the growth prospects from that, signing that trade deal really resolved one of the big sources of uncertainty for the global economy last year. And now it's just been replaced with another one, basically. So China accounts for a third of global growth. So spillovers there, a slowdown there absolutely has the potential to spill over to the U.S. And today you did see the Federal Reserve Board warning about this virus creating less appetite for risk, U.S. dollar appreciation, less trade, and lower commodity prices, so affecting the U.S. economy in a variety of ways.
Help me, and I want to stay with you for a little bit, but of course jump in, Sandeep. Help me level set on trade for a second, because I think we all feel a little lost in which parts of trade conversations we should be focused on. There's conflict brewing potentially with Europe. You wrote, Anna, about how we're starting trade talks with Kenya to stave off China. There's still uncertainty about trade with China. What should we be focused on here?
Yeah, so the president has declared victory for now with China, South Korea, Japan, Canada, Mexico. Some of those conflicts could rise up again at any moment, particularly China. But suffice to say, the administration is pretty happy with the deals that they signed with those countries. But they aren't stopping there. They're immediately turning to these other fronts, most notably picking what could be a really big trade fight with the European Union. They're also working on a very small deal with India, but with one which still could be the biggest trade deal that we've ever signed with India, potentially coming up in the next few weeks. There are discussions underway with the UK, but that's really not likely to be finalized until we see more about the terms under which The UK and the European Union will be trading. And then, as you mentioned, the U.S. announced this week that we're going to be launching trade talks with Kenya. And so they see that as a template for agreements with other African countries. And it's also an explicit effort to counter China's investments in Africa. The Trump administration says that Africa has been investing very heavily there, and they see these trade agreements as kind of a geopolitical toehold on the continent again.
Mm-hmm. And then, Sadiq, just like a couple of seconds left, but give me your, you know, 5-word breakdown of the jobs report today. Quite strong, except manufacturing. What do we make big picture?
Quite strong, except manufacturing. It means that we're in the roaring 2020s. I guess we're doing surprisingly well this late into an economic expansion in the almost at the 11-year mark for the economic expansion. But the fact that factories have not been growing as fast, their gains we got in the report in 2019 were the second smallest gain since 2010 when we came out of the recession. So it shows that all of these concerns about trade, about the state of the global economy, about what's happening overseas, that does have an impact in an industry that people still care a lot about in the United States. And if the factory sector falls, then other things could fall afterward.
All right. Thanks so much, you two. On Wall Street today. Thanks, guys. On Wall Street today, nobody liked that warning from the Fed. We are ending the week on a downturn. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One company that is not worried about growth is Uber, but the company at long last is starting to consider whether it should make some money now. Uber says it will become profitable by the end of 2020, but not before losing another $1 billion, just like the roughly $1 billion it lost last quarter. One of the biggest drains on profitability is the food delivery service Uber Eats. It is growing, yes, but still losing money. But Uber says it's sticking with Eats. In fact, it's going to double down and streamline. For some thoughts on what that looks like, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore.
Uber has been throwing money at Uber Eats.
They lost about $600 million in the December quarter, about $400 million of that. Two-thirds of their losses came from Uber Eats.
Gene Munster is a founding partner with Loop Ventures. He says focusing on Uber Eats is still a good idea.
It grew like a rocket ship. It was up 74%. Versus rides in the U.S., just to give some perspective, we're probably up 5%.
And Uber basically has millions of captive customers. These customers are hooked on Uber for rides. They're a sitting target for food delivery services. Brand recognition helps, too. Brad Gastworth is chief technology strategist at Wedbush.
They have the luxury of having a more household name. It's already becoming a word used to travel, right? You're going to Uber somewhere. You're not just going to go somewhere.
Uber is now trying to ditch anything that's dragging on growth for both rides and food delivery. Mark Schmolick is with Bernstein.
If they're not number one or number two in a particular market, they're either going to get out of it, divest it, which is what we've recently seen with Uber Eats in India, or they're going to find a way to invest in that market to reach that number one or two position.
Schmolick says Uber's other big strategy to become profitable is good old-fashioned raising prices and taking a bigger cut from rides and food deliveries. Any company has to balance growth and profits, he says, and Uber is shifting its focus to profits. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Warner Music Group is the third largest record label in the country. It publishes artists including Ed Sheeran, Lizzo, Madonna, and Metallica. And Warner is going public again. The label went private almost a decade ago when the industry was in pretty bad shape, but now things are looking up. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more.
Back in 2011, when Warner Music went private, the music industry had been in a downward spiral for years. CD sales were tanking, piracy was rampant. George Howard teaches business at Berklee College of Music.
It was an abject wasteland for the recorded music industry. It was a really, really dark time.
So what happened? Piracy drove Metallica to sue Napster, a platform that let people share music without paying for it. But the real change, says music analyst Bob Lefsetz?
Streaming services absolutely saved the music industry. It certainly started with Spotify.
Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora, and other platforms didn't take off immediately, but streaming is now about 75% of the industry's revenue. Michael Smith teaches information technology and marketing at Carnegie Mellon.
One way to think about this is water. We've got water fountains everywhere, and yet people will cheerfully pay a couple bucks for a bottle of water because it's convenient and I can carry it around. And I think exactly the same thing happened with Spotify.
Warner Music had revenue of $1.26 billion last quarter, its best quarter in about 15 years. Music sales are still not what they were when CDs were king, but streaming has labels feeling stable again. Or, in the words of Lizzo, baby, how you feeling? Feeling good as hell. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
And now to that story we promised about how disruptions in China because of coronavirus are affecting American business. Many stores and factories in China are still closed in an attempt to keep the virus from spreading. Companies like Apple and Ford have warned that the virus could disrupt their supply chains and hurt their bottom lines. But while big multinational companies might be able to move factories to other countries, smaller businesses could be hit pretty hard. Ann Harper is the CEO of OMG Accessories, and her company's supply chain starts in China.
OMG Accessories is filled with glitter, sparkle. We're known for our unicorns, and we sell over a million mini backpacks for girls annually. My supply chain starts in China. We have several hundreds of employees in China that works with my staff here in New York City, where they correspond every single day on development, on production, and really just A to Z on making and delivering the product. Obviously, first and foremost, it's like a lot of our staff is affected with, what's going on with the virus in China. And everyone's really traveled for Chinese New Year. So a lot of people got stuck. One of the main ladies that I work with, her family was from Wuhan. And when they came back, they had to be in isolation just as a preventative. So, it's just really scary, the fact that it's affected people that are close to my operation. I talk to the owner of my factory every single day, just checking in, obviously making sure that, all the close people around him are safe and everything, is okay from that standpoint. For me and for my company, we're really going to have some significant delays with our production and our future deliveries. I am in fear of really what tomorrow brings, because the company's gone from last year, 6-7 employees to 21 employees. And right now, it's definitely concerning to have this type of situation happen. And really just not knowing how big it's going to be.
That was Ann Harper, CEO of OMG Accessories. Coming up,
consumers who are stuck with these hunks of plastic in their homes that they have an emotional connection to, but no longer are supported by the companies.
When startups fail, you can be left holding the plastic. But first, let's do the numbers. A down day on Wall Street. Investors took the global economic temperature of the coronavirus, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 277 points, 0.9% to close at 29,102. The Nasdaq fell 51 points, 0.5%, finishing at 9520. And the S&P 500 was off 18 points, that's 0.5%, to end at 3327. But for the week, a very different story. The Dow actually added 3%, the Nasdaq climbed 4%, and the S&P 500 boosted 3.1%. Bonds also rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.58%, and you're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Molly Wood. Today you can buy smart TVs, smart doorbells, smart water bottles, even tiny sensors that tell you when to change your baby's diaper, because you know how hard it is to figure that one out. But what happens when everything around you is suddenly collecting data?
You have patients who've said, well, you know, I've got this computer that's controlling my heart and I have no insight into what it's doing. I can't see what data it's throwing off. I have to sort of go begging to my doctor if I want to see this. And even then, they might say no. All of these questions around, you know, what is personal data? What rights should you have over it? You know, you've seen some places trying to grapple with this stuff, but it's very sort of early days. And I think we're really just kind of trying to stake out what the problems might be at this point.
Make Me Smart is the podcast where Kai Ryssdal and I talk about tech, the economy, and culture. And this week, the Internet of Things. What could possibly go wrong? Make Me Smart, wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Britain's departure from the European Union is a mixed blessing for Lithuania. On the plus side, the London-based fintech company Revolut said this week that it will move some of its payment operations to Lithuania because of Brexit. But many in Lithuania still want to go the other way. One high school in the capital city Vilnius focuses on preparing its students to study at British universities. But since migration was such a big part of the Brexit debate, there's doubt now about whether those talented youngsters will get to study in the UK. The BBC's Kevin Connolly sent this report from Vilnius.
I can't believe what it looked at me with your Johnny Walker eyes.
Before I get to the point here, just take a moment to listen to Akvila Gelgenita. She has an audition at a drama school in London in a couple of weeks, so you might be hearing quite a bit more of her in the future.
I'll never talk again. Oh boy, you've left me speechless.
Like a lot of the smart, multilingual students at the Sevagas Gymnasia High School in Vilnius, Akvila still plans to come to the UK to study. Musical theatre for her, even if the thought of Brexit doesn't exactly have her dancing in the streets.
Lithuania does not have that strong roots of musical theatre at all. So I just want to get the closest to the culture of the West End, of the real musical theatre, of the real professionals.
In the streets of the government quarter of Vilnius, they have mixed feelings about migration, balancing the love of freedom of movement after the imprisonment of the communist era with the fear of a permanent brain drain. A quarter of all Lithuanians live overseas. The proportion in Britain has been falling, though. Foreign Minister Linas Linkevičius says that's because Brexit means uncertainty.
I believe it should change a bit because it will not be European Union space anymore. So conditions will be different, there will be more obstacles, so will be less, my prediction. And now we already, if people, as I said, coming back more than leaving, but those who are leaving are not leaving to UK anymore. They are more leaving to other countries already. So this trend changing.
Do you think Britain will miss its Lithuanian minority if it goes over time?
I wish so. I hope they miss a lot of things when reality will come.
You Young Agvila, by the way, isn't the only gifted musician at the Sevagas Gymnasia. This is Benis Matuzevicius offering us a little mellow improvisation. Benis has been thinking of studying medicine in the UK, but like the rest of the class, he's worried about future healthcare arrangements, student loans, and job prospects. The doubts might yet persuade him to look elsewhere.
Britain seems like, used to seem, before Brexit, like the safest option to go. Well, now with Brexit, for example, in my case, I was planning to study in Britain, but since there's this uncertainty about Brexit and whatever might change, I reconsidered finishing my medicine studies in Lithuania and having Germany as a second option.
As the UK and the EU begin to thrash out the details of a future relationship, we leave you with the creative improvisations of Benis Matuzevicius, a reminder that he's not the only person making things up as he goes along in Europe. Now, his future, and millions of others, will depend on exactly what the Brexit deal has to say about migration and freedom of movement. In Lithuania, I'm the BBC's Kevin Connolly for Marketplace.
If the uncertainties we have described in the program thus far haven't made it obvious, backup plans are generally regarded as a good idea. But in Silicon Valley, where it's all growth and scale and launch and hyperscale, backup plans all too often take a backseat, which means when a startup does fail, it's often unprepared for the fallout, and its customers can suffer as a result. Writer Ariel Pardes argues in a recent Wired article that this doesn't have to stay the norm. Ariel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about failure for a little bit, the inevitability of failure. But starting with this energy that exists at startups, which is almost by design the opposite, right? Like this vibe that absolutely ignores the possibility of failure.
Yeah. There's an old maxim that startups must either grow or die, but comparatively little attention is paid to the scenario in which you die, even though, by all accounts, most startups do fail. A conservative estimate is that 70% of startups will fail within 5 years. So there's a sort of pragmatic approach to just preparing for that inevitable outcome. What happens when you fail? What happens to your investors? What happens to your customers, your users, or the people who work at your company? And with sort of bigger startups, there's this sort of unfortunate effect where an investor or a founder might be able to walk away without any scars, but employees really bear the brunt of those failures.
Right. Once companies do mature, is there any evidence that that becomes a part of their planning or they get better at thinking about, you know, their own ends?
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly a world in which startups have a sort of, think of it like a prenup for your company, right? And so you sort of plan for that possible outcome. There are plenty of examples of companies, Picture Life is one that springs to mind, that have offered cloud storage for people's photos. And what happens when those companies run out of money and can't pay for server space? Everyone's photos disappear. So whether the way you plan for that is having a little bit of extra cash to make sure you have the runway to, you know, give your customers fair warning and notice, thinking about it is the most important part. And then what actually plays out is probably a little bit of a case-by-case basis.
And then can you give us another example? We talked about the photo sharing, but, you know, there are obviously much bigger companies even since then, like WeWork, that have imploded. Can you give us an example of how, you know, a company failing can have a big ripple effect on society?
Well, I think on the consumer side, there's a very emotional impact to services or products being discontinued. One of the examples I bring up in my piece is this wave of home robots that all went out of business last year. And there are some great, really heart-wrenching stories of consumers who are stuck with these hunks of plastic in their homes that they have an emotional connection to, but no longer are supported by the companies. But then I think in a broader sense, you know, you can think about scooter startups. There are lots of scooter startups that have crashed and burned within the last year. And who's left picking up all of those scooters that are littered across major cities? Well, that's the public. What happens when a major company like WeWork implodes? I mean, it's not just the company that's affected. It's everyone who partners with it. It's business developers. It's real estate developers. It's, you know, janitorials and custodial staff. It's, you know, much broader than just, you know, a set of investors and founders, you know, who are sort of flying away on their golden parachutes.
Right. Totally. Do you think that this is a question that investors could be asking too, or do you have any sense of whether they are? Like, could venture capitalists be saying to potential startup CEOs, you know, what's your worst case scenario here?
Yeah, my sense is that as a result of the chaos at companies like WeWork and with firms like SoftBank, investors are starting to think a little bit more about these end scenarios, how it will affect, you know, startup business models or the way investors choose to invest, I think really remains to be seen. But what's definitely clear is that every startup will die, even the big ones, eventually. So planning for that is, you know, prudent, not just for the companies, but for the investors as well.
Ariel Pardes is senior writer at Wired. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
This final note before we head out is a note of hallelujah, friends. Because you know that thing when you're trying to browse Netflix, like to figure out what to watch when you order pizza and collapse after an insane week of news on a Friday night? But if you hover for too long, then previews of shows and movies autoplay really loud and distract you from the hard job of thinking about what to watch, and then you can't make it stop and you want to throw your pizza at the screen? Well, finally, this message has gotten through, and Netflix has added an option to turn the previews off. Your weekend binges are saved. And don't even try to tell me that you like those autoplays or we cannot be friends. I mean it. And that is a wrap. The Dow down 277 points today. That was 0.9%. The NASDAQ fell 51 points. And the S&P 500 was off 18 points, 0.5% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I'm Molly Wood. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.